Greetings. This is Robert Noya, Editor-in-Chief of Sky and Telescope magazine. I'm on the phone with Dr. Seth Shostak, Senior Astronomer at the SETI Institute. Seth is the author of the cover story in our November 2010 issue, Closing In on ET. He is also the editor of a new book, Confessions of an Alien Hunter, A Scientist's Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Seth, thanks for joining us on the S&T podcast.
Well, it's definitely a pleasure to be here, Bob.
First of all, can you tell us about your new book, Confessions of an Alien Hunter, and especially how it differs from previous books about SETI?
It differs in several respects. To begin with, of course, it's updated. The situation as it was when I penned the last page of the book, which wasn't terribly long ago. So it has that. It has the advantage of currency, if you will. But the other thing is that I've gone into some detail about some of the strange phone calls and emails that I got here, and that's maybe the confessions part. I get communications from people just about every day. From people who are having difficulties with aliens, usually in their personal lives. That's because not insubstantial fraction of the population believes that we're being visited by extraterrestrials, and they call me up about it. So there is some of that. I do deal with the UFO phenomenon and the question of whether we could be visited. Also, what's different than other books is there's some consideration in there about the kinds of aliens we might hope to find and what it would mean to us if we did find them.
And speaking of aliens, there was this recent mega blockbuster movie, Avatar, that depicted this intelligent species called the Na'vi. What was your impression of that movie, and especially its depiction of these creatures? Intelligent creatures, I might add.
They were, yes. But unfortunately for them, they were a few hundred years behind us technologically. They had military aircraft, but they were just giant flying critters. So that was fortunate for them. They must have had a thicker atmosphere than we do, or maybe more oxygen in it so that they could have something that was as big as these things were to fly around in. But they were using bows and arrows as weapons and that sort of thing. Well, it suffered from the usual Hollywood conceit that the aliens fundamentally look just like us. I mean, you could fall in love with these aliens, and in fact, you know, some of the characters do. But they look that much like us. And generally speaking, you don't fall in love with anything you can't breed with. Maybe your dog. I don't know. But it's so there was that. Of course, Hollywood likes to have, if you will, anthropomorphic aliens, because then it's easier for the audience to identify with them, you know, to understand, are they being friendly? Do they like me? Do they want to just eat me? Do they want to kill me? What do they want to do? Take the planet, whatever. The one fault that I found rather amusing with the film that actually I thought was worth mentioning is the fact that we humans had gone to this planet, which is, I think it's a giant moon in any case. It's not very far. It's in the Alpha Centauri system. So it's, what, 4.5 light years away? That's about as close as you can be and not be in our solar system, to mine their unobtainium. Kind of an amusing name for this stuff. And I think in the film they tell you that it's $20 million a kilogram or a pound for this unobtainium. Well, I even back calculating that to today, because this film takes place about a century or so from now, a century and a half from now, even backdating it to today, taking out inflation and all that, it turns out that that's not terribly valuable. I mean, it's expensive. If you found some, you know, you'd be rich. But on the other hand, if you consider the costs in energy for a rocket to bring that back to Earth, I did this calculation. It's very expensive, and it's completely equivalent to ordering a book from Amazon but paying $60,000 for the shipping. So I thought that was a bit of an error there. The other thing is, of course, that you see the humans using the same technology we have today to fight the Na'vi, as if, you know, somehow military developments have come to a standstill for the next 150 years.
Right, not very likely.
Not likely.
And now getting a little bit more down to earth, what is the current funding situation for the Allen Telescope Array, and are there really good prospects that it will be expanded beyond its current 42 dishes in the next decade or so?
Well, I can't say that. I certainly hope so, and I'm certainly sanguine that that will happen. There's several lines of interest in terms of the funding. To begin with, the Air Force is using the instrument occasionally for tests for their space situational awareness programs, and that is they need to know where satellites are and stuff like that. So, you know, they put in a certain amount of money just to pay for the operation of the telescope for that. So that cover some of the costs of actually operating the telescope, but far and away not the entire cost, and certainly not the cost of expanding beyond the current 42 antennas. That has always been funded by private donation. The antenna has the name Allen Telescope Array because Paul Allen gave the money to get it started. These first 42 antennas and all the R&D that was necessary to develop not only the antennas, but all the electronics behind them. You know, that was largely funded by Paul Allen. That's why it has its name. And Paul Allen is still, I think, enthusiastic about the project, but he, of course, does want other people to step up to the plate, too. He doesn't want to be the only funder. I don't think that that's a financial consideration so much as simply, look, you know, I want to see other people step up to the plate here just to show how valuable this project is. And I am, as I say, optimistic. I'm endlessly optimistic, but I am optimistic that that will happen, that we will find the private monies, the donations to make this go. You know, how much money are we talking about? We're talking millions of dollars, but we're not talking hundreds of millions of dollars, and we're not talking billions of dollars, and we're certainly not talking trillions of dollars. And every day we talk about those big numbers in connection with one or another activity. Very often, even science experiments can cost, you know, billions of dollars, certainly that. So it's still relatively inexpensive science with the potential for a very, very big payoff. And so I remain optimistic that some people who have the means are going to say, you know, here's the first opportunity Homo sapiens has ever had to prove that we have some cosmic company.
And looking kind of at the history of SETI, or at least in recent times, that these radio SETI efforts have generally followed one of two broad strategies. Some involve sky surveys where they sweep around looking for very strong signals from one or more out of billions of stars. And then others target relatively nearby stars for transmissions. What are the advantages and disadvantages of each strategy, and which one is being most vigorously pursued right now?
Well, both strategies are being pursued right now. One is indeed the all-sky survey. For example, our colleagues across the San Francisco Bay here, about 50 miles from where I'm sitting at the University of California, Berkeley, are collecting data with the Arecibo telescope down in Puerto Rico, and they distribute some of those data for their SETI at home screensaver program that many people know about and use. Something like 7 or 8 million people have downloaded that screensaver. The thing is that that's kind of an all-sky survey, in the sense that because they're using a second antenna on the telescope, they don't get to choose where they're pointing. And every second and a half, they move to a new spot on the sky, more or less. So it's just sort of randomly sweeping the sky. Now, that has some advantages and some disadvantages. One disadvantage is you're just randomly sweeping the sky. So if you feel that there's more chance of finding a signal by looking at star systems, you're not doing that. But on the other hand, there are certain advantages. One advantage you could argue is that, well, we're not making any assumptions about where ET might be located. We'll just look at as much of the sky as you can see from Puerto Rico, which, you know, is about a third of the entire sky, by the way. The other advantage is that, well, they're under no pressure to process the data real time. Well, there's some pressure because they can't let it just accumulate, but they can spend their time with at least a fraction of the data and crunch the numbers as hard as they want and really dig deep down into those data looking for something. And that's the SETI at Home project, where you've got millions of computers crunching away on these data. They don't have to process it right away, because if they find a signal, they're not still pointed at that same spot on the sky, so they can't go back and just check it right away. So maybe that brings you down to another disadvantage, namely that if they do find a signal, they have to hope that it's still there months later or even years later. At the SETI Institute, we've typically had our control of the telescope, obviously the Allen Telescope Array. We have control of the telescope, so we can point it wherever we want to point it, and we typically look at star systems. The rationale there being, well, if you're looking for life in the desert, you could look at all the sand, but maybe it pays to concentrate on the oases. So that's almost philosophy, but that's what we do. On the other hand, since we do have control of the telescope, when we find a signal, we check it out within minutes. Within minutes, we do all the tests that show, hey, is this really ET, or is it just terrestrial interference from a satellite or a radar somewhere? So each approach has its pluses and minuses.
And another thing that's going on right now is that we have this NASA mission called Kepler, and the science team recently announced 7 new planets, but they have hundreds of candidates, and I know for a fact that some of them are roughly the size of Earth, and some of them will also be orbiting within their star's habitable zones. How will Kepler results influence future SETI search strategies?
Well, I think that there will be a direct effect, there will be an indirect effect. The direct effect, of course, is if Kepler comes up with a list of planets that look like they're, if you will, cousins of Earth. In other words, they're more or less the same size, so presumably they're rocky worlds like the Earth, and they're in the habitable zone, that is, at a distance from their star that would allow liquid oceans on the surface and atmospheres and all that. Clearly, we would look at any such worlds. I mean, this recently discovered planet, Gliese 581g, is the first one that's been found that seems to be in the habitable zone of its star. And, you know, we've looked at it a couple of times. Of course, we'll look at those. But do keep in mind that you could have looked at Earth with radio antennas for 4 billion years, right?
Right.
And not found any signals coming off of it. So just having one or two or three of these worlds isn't going to change the probability of a SETI success enormously. But what it will do, if the expected result comes in, and we will know in 2 years, because in 2 years, you'll have had enough time to see Earth-like worlds, for example, transit their star, get in front of their star three times. That's the minimum number for you to believe that it's really a planet and not some other effect. Well, the expectation is that 2 years from now, the Kepler team will announce that they found, who knows, a couple of dozen Earths, if you will, cousins of Earth. Now, we don't know that that's going to be the number, but that's sort of the guess. If that turns out to be the case, what that says is that there are tens of billions, with a B, tens of billions of Earth-like worlds just in our galaxy. And I think that that will be a real shot in the arm for SETI.
I should mention, by the way, about that Gliese 581G, it does look like that planet is going to go away. I've gotten some emails from several of the astronomers who do those radio velocity searches, and there's real doubts now whether that planet actually exists. But even if it doesn't, there's going to be lots of planets like that found in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah. Well, that would be a shame because there's been a lot of, you know, media play about Gliese 581g,
yeah,
and a lot of excitement. But, you know, that's the way science is. There have been plenty of announcements of planets in the very early days that turned out not to be planets. You're always working right at the edge of what your instruments can do, because if you're not at the edge, you're probably not doing very interesting science. And when you work at the edge, you can be fooled.
Yeah, that's a great point. And this sort of touches back to the avatar question I asked you earlier. But near the end of your Sky and Telescope article, you wrote about the possibility that by the end of this century, humans may be able to invent our own successors. So given the rapid advancement for us in computers and artificial intelligence, do you think if we ever detect signals from ET or perhaps even meet them in person, that we might be contacted by machines rather than flesh and blood creatures? Do you think ET will be biological or artificial in origin?
Well, I don't doubt that there are plenty of, you know, biological beings out there that are pretty clever. I mean, they claim that there are various biological beings on this planet that are pretty clever. Not in my neighborhood, I got to tell you, but, you know, maybe, you know, the dolphins and some other primates and certain birds and so forth and so on. So I'm sure there's plenty of biological beings out there that are fairly clever. But if you talk about the kind of things we might actually pick up, you know, signals from, then my bet with you, here's another bet for you, Bob. I think we already have a bet, but here's another one, that it will be machine intelligence. And the reason I say that is not just because I've probably seen too many bad science fiction films, but because if you look at the timescales, you invent radio, all right? We invented radio maybe 100 years ago, Marconi, whatever. You invent radio, and then within 100 years, you invent computers. And I think that within 100 or 200 years after inventing computers, you invent thinking machines. Now, I could be wrong about that, people who want to argue that you can never build a real thinking machine, but I think those people are whistling in the dark. I think you can. And so the point is that going from radio to inventing a machine that's cleverer than you are is only a time scale of 200 or 300 years. That's very short in terms of astronomical timescales. So I think that it's very likely that if you pick up a signal, it's coming from some intelligence that's more than 200 years ahead of us, and consequently that you're picking up machine intelligence. So that's my bet to you.
I want to mention, too, that a few weeks ago I attended a talk in California by UC Berkeley planet hunter Jeff Marcy, in which he outlined a very pessimistic outlook for SETI. His argument was somewhat similar to the one that I wrote about in my Spectrum column for the November issue. He points out that evolution has not really favored large brains, that it took an extremely long time for humans to arise on Earth, and that if ET were common, we should have seen ample evidence by now for its existence. But like me, he remains a very strong supporter of SETI, and he said to me, and I agree that searching for extraterrestrial life is still a very worthwhile endeavor, indeed perhaps the greatest scientific quest ever. So what's your response to people like Jeff and me who are very skeptical of SETI's chances but still are very, very supportive of the work of you and your colleagues?
Well, as long as they send us a donation, I'm okay with it. I do hear this fairly frequently. Paul Davies has a book out called The Eerie Silence, and the implication of the title is that, well, SETI hasn't found anything after 50 years. Of course, he will admit, or you talk to him, that, well, doggone it, we haven't really looked at very much of the sky very carefully. So the experiment, in a way, hasn't been done, not really done. So I think it's early days to say, well, you would have found something by now. I don't buy that argument particularly. But the other argument that, well, maybe intelligent life is something that doesn't cook up very commonly, doesn't happen very frequently, that is a very contentious issue. There are plenty of evolutionary biologists who've said the same thing. An obvious example, if the dinosaurs hadn't been wiped out 65 million years ago, you and I would not be having this conversation because there'd be dinosaurs here in the Silicon Valley. And, that it's hard to know whether that's a good argument or not. It's sort of like the rare earth argument that was made 10 years ago by Peter Ward and Don Brownlee, in which they said, the earth is really very special. You're not going to get other worlds that are as nice for complicated life. I don't buy it. Of course, obviously, I'm going to be biased because I work at the SETI Institute and we do the experiments to try and find these guys. But the reason I don't buy it is because, in the end, all those arguments come down to saying that Earth is a miracle, that what's happened here is extraordinarily unlikely. And kind of learned my lesson studying astronomy, that every time you thought there was something miraculous about you, you learned you're wrong. It's the well-known Copernican principle. And if the dinosaurs hadn't been wiped out, does that mean we would never have had intelligence? It hasn't taken that long for intelligence to get going, in fact. We've only had multiple cellular critters for the last 500 million years, which is only a tenth the age of the Earth. We've had life for a long time, but we haven't had complex life for a very long time. And obviously, intelligence probably requires complex life. I don't know, the protozoa aren't terribly brainy. So you could make the argument, and people do, that once you get complex life, once you get, warm-blooded critters that have to run around and catch dinner, so they have to be smart, and that sort of thing, that the development of intelligence might be as inevitable as the development of flying creatures, right? And we have lots of different things that can fly on this planet because there's a lot of advantage to being able to fly. Well, there's a certain amount of advantage to being smart, too. So I'm not at all pessimistic about that.
And it was interesting, this sort of harkens back a little bit to our Avatar discussion earlier, but for your article and my Spectrum column, we did receive several letters to the editor that kind of echoed some comments that Stephen Hawking made a few months ago, where he said, if aliens visit us, the outcome would be as much as when Columbus landed in America, which didn't turn out well for the Native Americans. We only have to look at ourselves to see how intelligent life might develop into something we wouldn't want to meet. Do you agree with Professor Hawking? And most of our efforts right now are concentrating on listening, which I personally don't see much harm in that. Do you think we should be making attempts to signal other civilizations?
Well, I think that there is value in transmitting, actually. And let me defend that on two grounds. First off, you learned a lot. By doing it yourself, you'll understand far better what somebody at the other end might be doing, and it might greatly improve your SETI experiment. So I think that there is some reason to do it. On the other hand, what about the danger? And I think that's what Hawking was really saying. Clearly, if the aliens land in Grover's Mill, New Jersey, it might not turn out so well for New Jersey. And if you don't live in New Jersey, you might say the state has it coming. But in fact, I don't feel that way because I used to live in New Jersey. So, if they actually visit you, the Native Americans were indeed not visited by the poets of Europe. They were visited by the very aggressive guys. So there's something to that. That's an historical thing. It applies to our species, maybe not to theirs, but you don't know. The bottom line is you don't know anything about alien behavior. But we're not talking about visitation. We're talking about, should you broadcast a signal that would give away your location? Should you do that? And nobody seemed to be very upset about putting plaques on the Pioneer and Voyager spacecraft, and they had maps of where we are. So, that was okay. Carl could do that. I don't think that there's any danger in broadcasting. And the reason, or if there is, I think it's irrelevant. The reason I think it's irrelevant is if you're going to worry about that, you have to worry about the fact that for 70 years, ever since the Second World War, we have been relentlessly broadcasting into space, not deliberately, of course, but via our television, our FM, and our radar. And you can say, oh, yeah, but those signals aren't very strong. Well, they're not. They're not that strong. But any society that could mount an interstellar attack will have the capability. They will have the telescopes and the antennas that could easily pick up that stuff. And in fact, they would be using their own star as a gravitational lens for the ultimate in telescopes. I mean, this beats your backyard 8-inch Matsutkov by a long way, by 11 orders of magnitude. And so and you can do this. I've done it. You can work out how easy it is for them to find things coming from Earth, and it's trivial for them to find signals coming from Earth with a capability like that. And indeed, they could see the street lamps from our cities. They could see the glow of our cities. They could easily do that. So if you're going to really worry about broadcasting, well, all I can say is that bell has been rung, and it's too late to worry about it.
Right. And just so you know, I am in very much agreement with you. I don't really see, you know, I certainly don't see any harm in listening and looking. And I think across the whole electromagnetic spectrum, we should be thinking about what we might expect to see from other civilizations. And it's hard for me to imagine that if we're going to reveal ourselves, the aliens probably know all about us anyway. So I do lose sleep over at night, but alien attacks, not one of them. And I guess we'll be seeing another, I think it's called Skyline, another one of these alien invasion movies is coming out in November. And hope that won't scare people away from thinking about SETI and transmitting, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, there are always people in those films who get onto the rooftops and start welcoming the aliens. I'm always with those guys. Of course, they usually get zapped right away.
So you don't have much longer to live then, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's right. I'll be the first to admit, if the aliens actually are, you know, headed for Earth, buy yourself some frozen pizza, grab your girlfriend or boyfriend, and head for the hills and just camp out and watch it all happen.
That's right. Well, that answers the questions I had, unless there was anything else you wanted to add that I haven't asked you about.
No, only this. I might point out, because there's a popular conception out there that SETI is the same year in, year out. We just continue to listen and so forth. But I do want to point out that thanks to the support of people who actually, you know, allow us to continue to do this experiment, the speed of the search, more or less doubles every 2 years. And that means that, you know, whatever experiment we do in the next 5 years just blows away everything that was done in the first 50. And so that's why I remain optimistic that before we're all gone and forgotten, that we will pick up a signal. So that's the reason for my optimism.
Great. Well, I really appreciate the time talking with me on the phone today, and also for taking the time to write this really interesting article, which, as I mentioned earlier, is our cover story for the November 2010 issue of Sky and Telescope.
Thank you very much, Bob.